Another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hi, this is Jeff Shapiro, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 25th, 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Is it time to liquidate the study of sociology? Why are some people richer than others? What drives societal ills or ignites a social movement? Why aren't people having more kids? These are some of the most important questions facing the country today. The answers shape our lives, polarize our politics, and supercharge our culture wars. Sociology, the discipline tasked with pursuing the answers, would seem well poised to take these issues on. For decades, its analysis informed policy on issues ranging from criminal justice to immigration to urban development. It introduced groundbreaking concepts like white-collar crime, gentrification, unintended consequences, and cultural capital. At various points, sociologists proposed and critiqued affirmative action, inspired and lambasted welfare reform, diagnosed and dismissed the breakdown of the nuclear family. Yet today, sociologists are embroiled in an ideological and existential battle of their own, one that is increasingly public and, at least in part, of their own making. The study of people, in other words, has a people problem. In 2023, Florida's then Commissioner of Education, Manny Diaz Jr., homed in on sociology as culture war enemy number one. It had been hijacked by left-wing activists, he said, leading the state to remove introduction to sociology from its general education curriculum at all public colleges and universities. The American Sociological Association promptly denounced the move as a blatant mischaracterization of the field and an effort to needlessly politicize a bastion of social science. Yet that same year, the ASA's president described sociology to its members as a form of liberatory praxis that is currently undergoing a renaissance as anti-racist, decolonial, feminist, queer, and transnational theorizing lead us to more inclusive insights. Meanwhile, one contingent, Sociologists for Palestine, is boycotting the ASA's annual conference. The theme, disrupting the status quo, next month. The reason? The ASA refused to authorize a vote on its own proposed boycott of Israeli academic institutions. This has drawn a counter-petition and a backlash so fierce that the Chronicle of Higher Education called it a war for sociology. Already, ASA membership is in steep decline, with membership at 9,400. Down from 14,900 at its peak in 1972. Now, sociology, long derided by many academics and humanities and the harder social sciences for its perceived squishiness, is being criticized from within. An increasingly vocal group of sociologists say that the discipline's cratering reputation is especially vivid when compared with economics, psychology, and political science, all of which can seem more serious and pragmatic, gateways to law school or business school, or an advanced degree in healthcare. Whereas those disciplines often use cutting-edge methodologies, sociology seems dusty and theory-laden. Even sociologists acknowledge that students are often drawn to the major because they're afraid of math or are sold on sociology as a means to activism. Starting in 2013, the number of students majoring in sociology dropped from 31,000 to 21,000 in 2024. One ZipRecruiter poll found that sociology among college grads most regretted majors. It's tempting to write all this off as another sorry example of academia gone off the rails. But the implications of sociology's implosion extend well beyond the confines of higher education, driving everything from what kids learn in secondary school to how workplaces and cultural institutions function, or become dysfunctional, to which ideas inform legislation. Sociology is in many ways the mother of all social sciences. She who had birthed dozens of disciplines ranging from criminology to post-colonial studies to ethnic studies. Unlike psychology, which operates on an individual level, sociology considers human phenomena in the aggregate and often over the long run. By examining trends in educational attainment, labor force shifts, and the effects of social media and AI, it can offer a grand scale picture of societal health. With roots dating back to the 19th century, European theorists like Max Weber and Emil Durkheim, sociology coalesced professionally in America during the Progressive Era. Many consider W.E.B. Du Bois the father of American sociology. Though trained as a historian, Du Bois, later a founder of the NAACP, used sociological methods to document the impact of slavery and Jim Crow on Black Americans. Du Bois' dual role as both a social scientist and an activist also inspired some of the fiercest debates over sociologists' role. In 1896, Du Bois defined sociology as, quote, the discovery of truth, unquote, and warned that if scholars dally with the truth to humor the whims of the day, they hurt the cause of scientific truth the world over. Traditionally, sociologists interpret his words as drawing a hard line between studying the truth and acting on it. But sociologists in the scholar-activist mold note that Du Bois also believed in using sociological truth in the pursuit of activism, promising in 1906 to never cease to protest and assail the ears of America. Sociology is fundamentally shaped by who is doing the work, many socialists argue. Didn't early sociologists claim to prove that white people's supremacy over other races based on supposed empirical evidence? Later research by conservative and neocon sociologists informed policies like broken window policing, racial profiling, welfare reform, and color blindness. For many contemporary sociologists steeped in postmodern theory, the insistence that a single truth exists is a fallacy, and objectivity itself a tool of oppression. Social phenomena are always shaped by power politics and competing interests, according to Lisa Ajar, who studies law and conflict with a focus on Israel-Palestine and chairs the Department of Sociology at UC Santa Barbara, one of the biggest sociology departments in the country. What I always tell students is that when it comes to the complex world that people live in and make and change, there's no single Archimedean point of truth, she says. There are just better and worse ways of presenting information and making arguments. According to an increasingly dominant contingent of sociologists, sociologists also need to engage with the public more forcefully. As bodies, we need to speak to the public, and we need to interpret public harm or advocate for the public good, says Sadie Grundy, a professor of sociology and African-American Black Diasporic Studies at Boston University. She compares the ASA to the American Heart Association, which uses its research and authority to advance messages intended to improve public health, providing guidelines and issuing warnings. Shouldn't the ASA and its individual members similarly deploy their research to inveigh against injustice and advance social change? In her view, sociology has an obligation to engage with the world. Sociologists who study immigration, for example, should speak out against ICE. I believe in sociology as a weapon, Grundy says. Other sociologists say the impulse toward activism is compromising not only the aim and the use of sociological research, but also the quality of the research itself. In lieu of engaging in objective analysis, the discipline is shaping and even bending the truth. Critics of the activist scholar model frequently cite Christian Smith's 2014 book, The Sacred Project of American Sociology, as persuasively diagnosing a discipline increasingly corrupted by what amounts to a quasi-religious activist impulse. Sociologist Sacred Project champions emancipation, autonomy, equality, justice, inclusion, diversity, open-mindedness, progress, tolerance, and cosmopolitanism, Smith wrote. In the end, that sacred project actually tends to produce sectarian narrowness, exclusion, uniformity, silencing, self-censorship, lack of debate, the negative sanctioning of nonconformists, and the debilitation of rigorous thought. Smith quit the ASA around the same time, demoralized by what he saw as a lack of self-awareness among his colleagues, whose work focused on the world's wrongs while failing to recognize their own. Professors teach from textbooks he describes as thinly veiled political progressivism watered down to pathetic mush. This past January, he resigned from the University of Notre Dame, where he was a professor of sociology for 20 years. From my point of view, sociology should be producing intellectuals who think deeply and insightly about the world, he says. Instead, it's producing technicians and activists. The painfulness of all this is that I believe sociology really matters and makes a contribution, but sociology is heading down the wrong road. Over time, I've thought to myself, what if we just liquidate the discipline? During her campaign for the presidency of the ASA this year, Melissa Wild, who's a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, signed a petition objecting to an ASA vote on sociologists for Palestine's proposed boycott. She believes that sociologists as a body should remain neutral. While the activists will not be constrained in their activism if the ASA becomes political neutral, the sociologists who do not want politics mixed into the research would be deeply constrained in their research and its impact if the ASA becomes activist, she said. She lost the election. To Alana Redstone, a sociologist who specializes in political polarization at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, sociology's troubles gained traction through a 1971 Supreme Court decision, Griggs versus Duke Power, which deemed that practices with a disparate impact on employees are illegal. According to her analysis, the moral equation of disparate outcomes with discrimination soon became enshrined within institutions like academia and the media. Underrepresentation or unequal pay among groups served as evidence of bias, she argues, leading to a proliferation of DEI practices, including concepts around unconscious bias, harm, and intent. Within sociology, it meant that any inequality among groups was de facto the result of discrimination, rendering moot other possible theories. Redstone says, we're treating questions around causation as settled. Even suggesting research into alternative sociological explanations is viewed as racist, morally wrong, and victim-blaming at best. The consequences are playing out across society. Once a claim is made that suggests we are on the right side of history, we are doing the work of good people who care about justice, that creates a lot of social pressure, she says. It forecloses disagreement, she says, and that has an enormous destructive effect on democracy. Redstone's critique builds in on others circulating within the profession. In interviews and on panels convened by organizations like Heterodox Academy, which is a nonpartisan organization devoted to academic reform, critics say that overt politicization of research, of teaching, of practice is actually killing the discipline. They refer to a discipline in disarray, write papers with titles like How Sociology Can Save Itself, and blog out sociology's pervasively dubious assumptions. You're listening to reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. They describe an atmosphere in which to get ahead, you must consistently submit to political litmus tests, publish accordingly, and pray that you make it to tenure without getting excommunicated. Specializing in a stodgy subject like religion, the military, or law enforcement, especially if one has anything positive to say, is as unfashionable as flaunting a fur coat. In their view, contemporary sociology's relentless focus on race, gender, and class, its emphasis on the need for social change over the benefits of social stability, and its obsession with inequality amount to an abdication of scholarly duty, decreasing the value of sociological research, reducing its impact, and undermining public trust. According to one analysis, 80% of articles published in today's flagship sociology journals touch on inequality. This spring, a damning report by Vanderbilt and Washington University called out the social sciences for a distinctive form of politicization in which the scholarly enterprise is taken to be subordinate to or in the service of political, social, or moral goals beyond the advancement of knowledge and understanding. Activist logics are taking over scientific logics, says Ashley Rubin, the sociologist who worked on the Vanderbilt and Washington University report. If you look at the data on so much of the current research on capitalism, sexism, racism, you'll see that sociology is misrepresenting the evidence, concealing the evidence, or distorting it outright, says Kevin McCaffrey, a sociologist at the University of North Texas. He points to numerous studies purporting to show the pervasiveness of poverty in America, rampant sexism in the hiring of women, and the harms inflicted on microaggressions. Every day, the goal in my work is to not do politics, McCaffrey says. My job is to imagine someone in my mind who has the opposite assumptions and go back and forth with them to test my ideas. I don't think most sociologists realize the magnitude of their own bias and the weakness of the evidence supporting their claims. McCaffrey and other empirists accuse scholars of engaging in asymmetrical analysis depending on whether groups are considered minoritized, which skews the results. And an emphasis on systems denies groups or individuals within groups any form of agency. He believes that sociologists owe it to the students and the public to be transparent about these failures, including years of compromised research. McCaffrey is also the editor of the journal Theory and Society, a position he took on in 2023 after the publisher fired its previous editor. McCaffrey decided to reorientate the publication in a more open and rigorous direction, and the entire staff promptly resigned. The enforcement of ideological conformity within sociology is so intense, it's impossible to ignore, he says. Meanwhile, trust in higher education is collapsing. That's being driven in part by politicized degrees in social science, and in that respect, sociology is the belly of the beast. Juca Sablonian, a professor of criminology and sociology at Wayne State University, says too much sociological research is a waste of resources and a missed opportunity. Don't we want to learn about the causes of crime? Do we want to know whether we have Venezuelan gangs in Colorado? Or do we just say policing is bad, parole is bad, they destroy communities, cops are bigots, and the real problem is police violence? Musa El-Garbi, a sociologist at Stony Brook University, tells the story of a professor at Columbia University who assigned the children's board book Anti-Racist Baby in an introductory sociology class. She opened up the first class by holding up the book and declaring, "This is what the field of sociology is about." What El-Garbi calls normie beliefs, ones that are often true and well-founded, are relentlessly undermined with the discipline You think religion is good? You think men and women are different? Believe that marriage is stabilizing or that police are necessary? Wrong. In this way and others, he says professors may unwittingly discourage or alienate students. In many sociology classes, he says, society is relentlessly depicted as bad, 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 and in ways that offer a less accurate understanding of America. Based on the narrative of sociology, you'd think that America is some kind of racist hellscape and that white people are uniquely depraved, El-Gharbi explains. In reality, people get along across difference in America better than any other country on the planet. There's more to peak military performance than testosterone. I've seen it. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is correct that combat requires soldiers be in top physical condition, but it goes way beyond hormones. There's no question that some ground combat requires almost superhuman strength in American soldiers. This article is by Sebastian Younger, who says that he was embedded from 2007 to 2008 with an airborne infantry platoon in Afghanistan's infamous Korangal Valley and watched young men carry spine-crushing loads of gear, ammunition, and weapons at 7,000 feet in exceedingly rugged terrain, which is where the Taliban preferred to hide out. On another embed, the mortar team said that they carried well over 100 pounds each. The men in the Korangal were so heavily weighed down that when they got shot at almost daily, they practically walked to cover on steep hills. The U.S. mission was to prevent the Taliban from using the Korangal as a base from which to attack more populous areas. But the U.S. troops were chasing an enemy that could move four or five times faster in that terrain. There were no women in the unit I was with, and virtually no men over the age of 30. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is correct that such jobs require peak fitness. This month, in a move, he said, was part of an effort to optimize performance, he declared that all warfighters ages 30 and older in the U.S. military will be tested annually for testosterone deficiency. Testosterone has been clinically associated in studies with physical strength, elevated red blood cell counts, higher cardiovascular capacity, and aggression, all of which can help enormously in any kind of physical contest. Men can have as much as 20 times more testosterone than women, resulting in significantly higher athletic ability. But studies show that their levels start to drop around the age of 30. Obesity, chronic stress, lack of sleep, alcohol abuse, and close contact care of an infant can also reduce levels. Supplemental testosterone can change that, of course, and Hegseth said military personnel of either sex could receive testosterone replacement therapy if treatment was recommended. Every single day you are pushed to your absolute physical and mental limits to master the profession of arms, he said in a video captioned "The High T Department of War," announcing the initiative. By addressing these health markers early on, we're keeping you on the leading edge of lethality. But low testosterone levels are not always a problem for physical performance, and testosterone deficiency is hard to test for because it varies so much during the urinal cycle. Luckily, the military already has tests, boot camp, infantry school, and the job itself. Men who cannot handle the physical and psychological demands of a place like the Korangal are either chaptered out or removed to a rear echelon job where they won't impede combat operations. I recall a tough, strong corporal giving up on a steep hill when we were wide open to enemy gunfire. "I'm just smoked, Sarin," he explained to his team leader, who shot back, "You don't have the right to be smoked here." The young man pushed down to cover at the top of the hill. To be selected for the 173rd Airborne, this man would have almost certainly been able to score 270 points in the U.S. Army's fitness test at the time. The test metrics have recently changed. That means he would have likely completed 60-plus push-ups and some 70 sit-ups, both sets in under 2 minutes, as well as a 2-mile run in under 14 and a half minutes. That would have qualified him to join a union where every man would be expected to carry a minimum of 25 pounds of body armor and an additional 40 to 50 pounds of weapons, gear, water, and ammunition. M240 machine gunners carry even more. At least a 27-pound weapon and 20 pounds of linked ammo along with their personal gear. In hot weather, it's impossible to carry enough water to sustain that kind of effort. I once watched the men get so dehydrated that they were forced to drink bags of intravenous fluid pulled from their medical kits. In cold weather, stopping was dangerous because the men sweated so much that they were at risk of hypothermia. These men were the warfighters of Hegseth's speech, but only a very small percentage of the U.S. military sees that kind of sustained ground combat, and many of those soldiers are in mechanized units. In other words, a relatively small percentage of soldiers and Marines require the kind of testosterone levels that Hegseth is seeking, and their jobs are an ongoing testosterone test. There's virtually no way for a soldier to make it through the Karengo with the hormone levels of a middle-aged man. Far more typical are jobs like the ones Hegseth had during his active duty. He guarded detainees at Guantanamo Bay, was a civil affairs officer in Iraq, and taught counterinsurgency classes in Afghanistan. In a military composed mostly of non-infantry and non-combat personnel, testosterone is predominantly a quality of life issue. Anyone suffering from low testosterone might be told by a medical professional that they would benefit from supplements, but there are downsides. A 2016 study of the scientific journal Biological Psychiatry found that dominant and impulsive men who were given supplemental testosterone were at risk of acting aggressively within 60 minutes of taking it. Hegseth's high T video makes no mention of mental health evaluations that might accompany guidance about whether to take testosterone. Men with traits of aggression and impulsivity could put themselves and others at enormous risk with those supplements, particularly if they are also carrying a firearm. The risk of excessive dominance and impulsivity might be worth it to the military to keep a warfighter in the field, but probably not a supply clerk or a civil affairs officer, which are jobs that become by either sex at any allowable age. And the possibility that supplemental testosterone could even make some service members less combat effective by triggering physical and emotional side effects is a risk in and of itself. Is my nervous system really dysregulated? By Emma Rosenbaum. A couple of months ago, I made the mistake of lingering on an Instagram post that promised how to, quote, regulate your nervous system, unquote. It offered a series of tips for slowing my breath, soothing my system, using gentle movement, and letting myself feel. What the post didn't explain was the problem that it was solving. Did my nervous system need regulating? How would I know it if it did? Your nervous system isn't asking for perfection, the caption read. It's asking for safety. Turns out, I inadvertently entered a booming space in the wellness sphere, one in which people identifying as experts, holistic coach and therapists, use the term nervous system dysregulation to describe symptoms associated with stress and burnout. Some research does exist around the bodily effects of PTSD and chronic stress, but there's no official DSM diagnosis for this particular condition. It appears to have been hive-minded into existence by social media around the time of the pandemic. 6 years later, the concept of a regulated nervous system has reached critical mass. Mel Robbins and Jay Shetty have each dedicated multiple podcast episodes to the subject. Gymnast Jordan Childs has said naps help regulate my nervous system. A post by Goop's account in February featured Gwyneth Paltrow. sharing her nervous system reset, which included a relaxing bath, a superfood smoothie, and a girls' weekend in Ojai, California. It's appealing to believe that abstract idea of the body's nervous system, the network made up of the brain, the spinal cord, and the nerves, involving everything from breath to thought to digestion, is something that we control if only we work hard enough. I've watched videos of people doing cold plunges, giving themselves ear massages, and contorting themselves into impossible stretches, all in the name of fixing dysregulation. You're listening and reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. When people online refer to the nervous system, they're using a metaphor to talk about themselves physically, and they're using a term that sounds sciency, said Lisa Barrett, a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University and the author of the best-selling 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. And when they say they're dysregulated, what they mean is, I feel distressed, I feel exhausted, I feel overwhelmed, she said. But much of the language surrounding this concept is neurobulb crap, Barrett said. Stress is real, and Barrett knows that there's a lot of it out there. We're living through a time of uncertainty, and persistent uncertainty is like low-grade inflammation on your immune system, she said. In other words, stress can be bad for you. But framing it as a problem of the nervous system is all a massive simplification, she said. The pathologizing of bad feelings is a very modern concept. What used to be thought of as the attendant physical sensations of life, occasional fast heartbeat, quick breath, shakiness when something goes wrong, is now some kind of clinical condition. Paradoxically, this shift has happened as the public has gained greater knowledge about mental health issues. Words such as trauma, boundaries, and narcissism have entered the mainstream, and they're even more misused and diluted. And it's not without business potential. For nervous system regulation, you can buy a fight or flight supplement kit from Aegis Formulas for $132. Or a vagus nervous stimulator from Truvaga for $499. You can even hire a nervous system specialist. Paltrow has one to help her with mental health, she said on her Goop podcast, though she hasn't shared specifics of what said specialist does in order to help her. One of the topic's biggest proselytizers, Jim Curtis, a hypno-meditation coach, probably better known as Jennifer Aniston's boyfriend, who has over 1 million Instagram followers. He's emerged as a kind of guru for those seeking to cure dysregulation. In an emailed statement, Curtis said that his own chronic illness taught him that stress and fear can be profoundly influence how we feel and live. And he's seen people experience meaningful improvements in their well-being after learning to regulate their emotional responses. He charges $2,995 for his Awaken and Align course. But what if all this scrutiny on our own internal state is actually part of the problem? Rather than looking inward, Barrett said, perhaps we should be moving back toward other people and seeking professional help if the stress is too persistent. Consuming is not communicating, she said. Go have coffee with a friend when you're stressed and stop scrolling Instagram for tips. When one nanny isn't enough, CEO parents hire a whole team. One family assistant isn't cutting it anymore, so some parents are spending upward of $250,000 on staffers for their children. Luxury services offer potty training, baby chefs, and bike riding lessons. As a mother of two, this is by Jordy Lippy McGraw, there are certain tasks that Christine Landis won't do. She's never clipped her children's toenails. Too anxious for that, she said, so the nanny handles it. Most nights, the family assistant takes care of bath time. Landis also hands off what she calls repetitive play, reading the same book 5 times or watching her toddler open and close the door for 45 minutes. To make this possible, Landis, who lives in San Diego, spends roughly $250,000 a year, running a household staff that includes a family assistant who lives on the property, a weekend nanny, a personal chef, and a housekeeper. One nanny isn't cutting it anymore. Wealthy working parents like Landis are employing teams of people to handle the work of raising their children, including specialists to potty train toddlers, teach their kids to ride a bike, manage school applications, and pack trunks for summer camp. Call it CEO parenting, treating the modern family as a small enterprise and delegating low joy tasks. Every hour I'm not bogged down with the doing is an hour I get to show up fully present with my kids, said Landis, 44, a former CEO of a fintech company and the founder of Peacock Parent, a company that uses AI to help families manage their homes. Families like Landis's rely on a growing industry of high-end services to accommodate staffing up their households. Quintessentially, a global concierge firm whose U.S. membership begin at $25,000 a year, has handled preschool applications, pet procurement, and six-month family sabbaticals with traveling tutors. Olivia Fountain, Director of Operations at Household Staffing, an agency with offices in New York and Philadelphia, said that the role that had surged most in recent years was what her agencies called a family assistant nanny. During school hours, the role includes managing schedules, coordinating appointments and activities, running errands, and overseeing day-to-day household administration, then transitions to childcare when the kids return home. Family assistants, who typically have childcare backgrounds, combine the duties of a house manager, personal assistant, and a nanny. Her agency has fielded all sorts of parenting requests, equestrian nannies, who travel to tournaments, baby chefs to prepare culturally specific purees, personal stylists for the children. One recent request, Fountain said, came from a parent desperate to get their child a specific limited edition Labubu, the collectible figurines that clip onto handbags, and tasked the nanny with posting across social media, offering to pay whatever it took until one turned up. It's the million little things, Fountain said. Wrapping a birthday present, unloading the backpack, the Amazon boxes that need to be broken down. Those are all the things that make your day disappear. Seth Norman Greenberg, vice president of the household staffing firm Pavilion Agency, said he once placed a caregiver for a family practicing diaper-free parenting, expecting the staff to read cues and rush the baby to the bathroom in time. The agency, based between New York and Los Angeles, often serves clients who rotate across their 5 to 10 homes with full staff at each property. They've recently pushed the job even further. Greenberg has placed nannies because they had experience working on yachts or could tolerate helicopter travel. We are busier than we've ever been, he said of the firm that he founded in 1962. The environment, the economy, is just producing these millionaires and billionaires. Celebrities like Emma Grid have helped usher this style into the broader culture. Grid, co-founder of Kardashian brands Skims and Good American, has described herself as a max 3-hour mom, spending weekend mornings with her 4 children before moving on to activities that, quote, fill my cup, unquote. Cutting sandwiches into star shapes? That was never it for me, she told the Wall Street Journal earlier this year. She relies on nannies, cleaners, a chef, and a chief of staff, which helps afford time for high-impact core memories like vacations with her children. Potty training consultants who worked intensively with toddlers over several days charge anywhere from $600 to $4,500. Private bike riding lessons can run anywhere from $80 to $450 per session. Don't want to pack your kids up for summer camp? You can hire someone for $125 an hour. For families who want full-time dedicated staff, a travel nanny costs $120,000 to $170,000 a year. A private governess, a tutor who blends academics with social development, can today reach $200,000. Alexandra Fine, a mother of three young kids, spends about $85,000 a year on a team of six that includes nannies, a home organizer, a handyman, and a virtual assistant. Every hour I spend folding laundry or scheduling a repair person is an hour I'm not present with my kids, said Fine, the CEO of Dame Products, a sexual wellness company. That's not a philosophy. That's not a philosophy. That's math. For some parents, the small, mindless tasks often are what's meaningful about being a parent. Hand them off, they argue, and you might miss out on connecting with your kids. Ivana Greco, a stay-at-home mom and former attorney who runs The Homefront, a Substack about family life, and homeschools her four children, said these duties create opportunities to get closer to her children. The most meaningful moments that I have with my children are completely unexpected, she said. They happen because we spend time together. She worries about what children might absorb from arrangements with hired help, whose presence they register, and whose they miss. If you're not the one who shows up, she said, your child notices. Landis, the Peacock Parent founder, said that when she felt sick about having her newborn, the nanny brought her tea and orange juice without being asked. It was, she said, one of the most unexpectedly moving moments of early motherhood. The first time one of her children said, I love you, to that nanny and heard it said back, Landis felt a flash of uncertainty. But then it passed. There's no world where my child doesn't know I'm their mother, she said. Our bond, our love, it's irreplaceable. Some responsibilities she'll never give up. The time to talk about our day, snuggle in bed, read books. That's really special to me. For Landis, the work doesn't go away. It still lives in her head. As the mental load of decisions, coordination, imagining the invisible architecture that keeps her house running. The doing was handled, Landis said, but the thinking was still mine. The view from inside Maine's manic political summer. A local news reporter on how the effort to replace Graham Plattner in the Senate race feels on the ground. By Alex Seitz Wald. The first time I saw Graham Plattner, he was catering another political candidate's event. The very same political candidate, Troy Jackson, is now poised to take Plattner's place as the Democrat in Maine's Senate race. It's a reflection of how tumultuous the past year in politics has been in Maine, which is typically known for its steady statesmen. When the event took place last August on a farm in Belmont in the mid-coast region of the state, Jackson was a progressive candidate for governor. He delivered a speech with much of the same policies as Plattner, but less of his charisma, speaking hesitantly in the Acadian accent that marks him as a son of the North Maine woods. Standing in the back of a tent strung with bistro lights, Plattner was shucking oysters. Plattner had announced his candidacy for the U.S. Senate a week earlier, but his campaign was so young and unplanned that he agreed to cater the event when running for Senate wasn't anywhere on my plate, he explained to the crowd. This is an event for Troy, and I don't want to monopolize it, but I do just want to introduce myself, Plattner said. He then launched into a fiery stump speech, showcasing the Everman charisma that would soon make him a national phenomenon. The audience came to see Jackson, and they left talking about Plattner. Less than a year later, Plattner is a political pariah, and the candidate he upstaged, and who finished third in the gubernatorial primary, is poised to replace him in a dash to Election Day. Whether Jackson can defeat longtime Republican incumbent Senator Susan Collins is one of the most consequential questions in the midterm. With all that's happened, the vibe here is almost manic. And I am feeling the attention of the rest of the country in a way I never expected when I left my job of a decade covering elections for NBC News in Washington, D.C., and relocated to Mid-Coast Maine in 2022. Everywhere I go as a local reporter, I hear people talking about all the possibilities of the next few months and all of the personalities involved, often on a first-name basis, and with the sense of familiarity only possible in a small state. Yard signs crowd rural intersections. I'm being hounded by pollsters, direct mailers, and campaigners, but also readers and friends in the aisles of Hannaford or at school pickup, asking questions and offering opinions with a level of informed specificity I've never encountered. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review, on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Maine has one of the highest rates of voter turnout in the country, according to analysis from the University of Florida's Election Lab. People care about their town government and taxes. They attend local meetings and often know someone who has served in some elective office or committee. At the Midcoast Villager, the paper that I work for, we receive letters to the editor that cite figures buried in the town budget or obscure provisions in state law that might apply to controversial proposed development. Last weekend, over 17,000 Maine Democrats gathered in hastily organized county party caucuses to choose delegates who will officially select a replacement for Plattner on Saturday. But even before those delegates could cast their votes, it was clear that Jackson was the favorite. A state senator who came up through the organized labor movement, Jackson's experience counting votes and working insider processes helped him organize his opponents, helped him out-organize his opponents. He nearly swept all potential nominating delegates in county Democratic caucuses. Not every Democrat I talked to was happy with the outcome. Caucus weekend cut short a rushed nomination process. Some voters and delegates that I talked to said the overwhelming outcome for Jackson didn't reflect the will of voters and showed the flaws in a process that they feel favored him too greatly. Candidates had not officially qualified for the ballot when he was declared the presumptive winner. And even Jackson's supporters acknowledge he's not known as a stellar communicator, that he gave him a bit of a tough hang with a sharp temper. When I moderated a forum with the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, he didn't disguise his size as I took an audience question when we were over time. To the minds of many Mainers, the best case scenario for Democrats is that Jackson could be a bit of an LBJ to Plattner's JFK, the charismatic but flawed outsider giving way to an uncouth but more experienced operator who might prove capable of winning and even more capable at legislating. In the worst-case scenario for Democrats, he would be a ghostly echo of Kamala Harris following Joe Biden in the 2024 presidential campaign, a promising but perhaps undermatched replacement dragged down by chaos, infighting, and the flaws of predecessors. Christopher Nolan breaks down the epic scene at the center of The Odyssey. The filmmaker's IMAX version of the Greek classic reinvents literature's most famous plot device, applying old-school Hollywood techniques to conjure the intense drama of the Trojan horse. On a vast beach in Morocco last year, waves were pummeling one of humanity's oldest plot devices. Christopher Nolan's version of the Trojan horse, 35 feet tall and rearing on hind legs, was half buried in the sand on the Atlantic coast. In the filmmaker's imagination, the trick of hiding Greek warriors inside a wood contraption was more believable if it looked like a waterlogged offering to a god left by a departed army. The horse would become a centerpiece in Nolan's moonshot interpretation of the Odyssey and a vessel for some of the movie's most riveting scenes and important symbolism. It would be emblazoned on movie posters, erected as a promotional monument outside theaters, and rendered in plastic as a $70 popcorn holder. On the beach, however, it wasn't clear if the horse would survive its scenes. Nolan's crew watched anxiously as the surf tore pieces off their colossal prop of fiberglass, wood, and steel, and later took further beatings as they worked out how the 8,000-pound horse could be dragged over dunes and log rollers by actors with ropes. As for the director responsible for it all, I'm feeling cool as a cucumber in those moments, Nolan recalled in a recent interview. 12 previous movies gave him the confidence that his team could solve the myriad challenges posed by his 13th, the biggest production of his career. The Odyssey had to conjure the grand scale and mythic weight of Homer's epic poem. The original hero's journey, which has been a wellspring of Western storytelling for thousands of years. And because Nolan is a filmmaking purist and one of Hollywood's most high-profile champions of the theatrical experience, his Odyssey also needed to deliver on behalf of cinema itself. As the first Hollywood feature shot entirely on IMAX film cameras, the movie has been marketed as an awe-inspiring spectacle from a director whose fans would be disappointed with anything else. Its fantastical elements, from the ambush on Troy led by Matt Damon's Odysseus to a giant cyclops that gobbles his men in a cave, were created primarily with physical effects for a more visceral impact. Nolan's mandate was to somehow make myths plausible. "My rule of thumb for everything in this movie," he said, "we have to give the audience reasons to believe." The Odyssey has been doing just that in theaters. Its opening weekend generated $264 million worldwide, which was the largest global debut ever for the director. The image of the beached horse first lodged in Nolan's mind over 20 years ago when he was in the running to direct a movie based on another Homeric epic, The Iliad. But instead of helming Troy, starring a glistening Brad Pitt as Achilles, Nolan embarked on a genre-shifting Batman trilogy. After the director's Oppenheimer raked in $976 million in theaters in 2023 and won 7 Oscars, Nolan got Universal Pictures to back a $250 million production of The Odyssey, stacked with A-list actors, requiring 5,300 costumes and spanning 91 days of filming in 6 countries. Nolan's biggest leap was in trying to shape a tale from the Bronze Age into a gripping summer popcorn movie. In Homer's Odyssey, about the hero's 10-year quest to return home from the Trojan War, the story zigzags among locations, time periods, and narrators. Odysseus himself doesn't appear in the book until part 5. The story of the wooden horse, as most translations call it, gets only brief references in Homer's epic, cited in passing an example of Odyssey's cunning. Details of how it actually worked are very few. Our collective image of a humongous horse on wheels came down from centuries' worth of artists' interpretations. A Greek vase from 675 BCE, paintings from the 18th century by Italian artist Giovanni Domenico Tiepolo, grandiose movies in the swords and sandals category, such as 1956 Helens of Troy, directed by the Sound of Music filmmaker Robert Wise. Nolan stood his horse on 2 legs to make him more dynamic and monumental. He borrowed its pose from a photograph taken of his production designer, Ruth de Jong, on the back of a rearing mount. He sank the horse in sand past its haunches as a cinematic homage. "My inspiration was really the Statue of Liberty at the end of the original Planet of the Apes," the director said. But for all of Nolan's visual certainty, his crew faced technical unknowns. The director's method was to work out the specific in the film's environments, namely the beaches of Morocco's Astoria and in the mountain village of Aida Ben Ahado, where Troy was constructed. "We're having meetings about how do we keep the thing standing? How heavy is it? How many people do we need to drag it?" recalled cinematographer Hoyt van Hoytema, who also shot 4 previous Nolan films, starting with Interstellar. The crew learned to quickly repair the horse damaged by waves, and they discovered it took about 250 actors and stunt performers to haul the giant prop. Once we realized these guys could do it for real, they got cellular about it. "They would just drag this thing right over the dunes. It was incredible," Nolan said. "So Hoyt and I are able to just look at it and go, okay, let's put a camera on this. Where do you want to shoot from?" Wrestling with the physics on a school bus-sized prop was a way for the filmmakers, and thus the audience, to experience something closer to a real world, van Hoytema said. Working with Chris is always a little bit like the filming version of method acting, the cinematographer added. The horse was the latest example of his pursuit of plausibility. For me, it's a very Nolan-esque icon. At one turning point in the Odyssey, as Odysseus' son, Telemachus, who's Tom Holland, searches for news of his missing father, the Greek general Menelaus, John Bernthal, offers up a war tale from Troy. You hear the story of the horse, Menelaus says, but did you hear it from the inside? The line is like Nolan nudging his audience to say, check this out, a human pyramid of Greek commandos packed into a dark hollow. They struggle to stay silent and survive as seawater floods in the horse tips over and a Trojan sword plunges into their hiding place and at least one body. To create the sequence, Nolan's team built a sort of silo on the beach, rigging it with the minuscule LED lights to mimic sunlight leaking through chinks in the horse's hull. Damon, Bernthal, and up to 25 others crammed into the tank vessel and clung to its crossbeams as cold water pumped in and the silo rocked. Nolan and Van Hoytemer were in there too, armed with IMAX camera to capture the action inside, pretty much like a documentary, the director said, a very small, grubby, claustrophobic documentary. The wooden horse bookends the Odyssey, in which time fragments and the plot circles back on itself, a signature of Nolan's films. Like the cataclysmic detonation set off by his protagonist in Oppenheimer, Odysseus' ruse unleashes a slaughter that scars the hero and helps explain his torturous journey and violent homecoming. It's exactly what I wanted, Nolan said, of his cinematic version, 2 decades in the making. But it's so much more. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the July 25th, 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Jeff Shapiro. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have The New York Times. At 9 o'clock is Harper's Magazine. And at 10 o'clock is episode number 13 of Hope Rises by David Baldacci. Stay with us. If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. Any questions on Dash's tapes for radio reading? Call us at 716-821-5555, and thanks for caring. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability,